ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमम् देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरये। नष्टप्रायेष्व भद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवत्युत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 2 चैप्टर 9 answers by citing the Lord's version, text 19.
Tam priyamanam samupasthitam kavim prajavisarge nijashasanarhanam बभाष ईषत् स्मित शोचि सा गिरा प्रिय प्रिय प्रीत मन करे स्पृशन।
प्लीज चैंट। तम अंटू लॉर्ड ब्रह्मा प्रियमाणम worthy of being dear, samupasthitam, present before, kavim, the great scholar, praja, living entities, visarge, in the matter of creation, nija, his own, shasana, control, arhanam, just suitable, babhashe, addressed, ishat, mild, smita, smiling, shochisha, with enlightening, gira, words, priyaha, the beloved, priyam, the counterpart of love, prītamanāha, being very much pleased, kare, by the hand, sprishan, shaking. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. And seeing Brahma present before him, the Lord accepted him as worthy to create living beings, to be controlled as he desired. And thus, being much satisfied with him, the Lord shook hands with Brahma, and slightly smiling, addressed him thus. Purport. The creation of the material world is not blind or accidental. The living entities who are ever conditioned or nityabaddha are thus given a chance for liberation under the guidance of his own representative like Brahma. The Lord instructs Brahma in Vedic knowledge in order to diffuse this knowledge to the conditioned souls. The conditioned souls are forgetful souls in their relationship with the Lord. And thus the period of creation and the process of dissemination of Vedic knowledge are necessary activities of the Lord. Brahma has a great responsibility in delivering the conditioned souls, and therefore he is very dear to the Lord. Brahma also does his duty very perfectly by not generating the living entities, but also by spreading his party for reclaiming the fallen souls. The party is called the Brahma Sampradaya, and any member of this party to date is naturally engaged in reclaiming the fallen souls back to Godhead, back home. The Lord is very much anxious to get back his parts and parcels, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita. No one is more dear than one who takes the risk of reclaiming the fallen souls back to Godhead. There are many renegades from the Brahma Sampradaya, whose only business is to make men more forgetful of the Lord, and thus entangle them more and more in material existence. Such persons are never dear to the Lord, and the Lord sends them deeper into the darkest region of matter, so that such envious demons may not be able to know the Supreme Lord. Anyone, however, preaching the mission of the Lord in the line of the Brahma Sampradaya is always dear to the Lord. And the Lord, being satisfied with such a preacher of the authorized bhakti cult, shakes hands with him in great satisfaction. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapadakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare 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 Krishna. I think it's better to keep the door open, isn't it? Because every time it opens and closes, there is a disturbance. Hare Krishna. So a very historic and monumental event is taking place. Newspapers don't talk about these monumental events. The history books taught in school don't talk about these events. The only history books that talk about them are books like the Srimad Bhagavatam. But then in the schools and universities and in general, people consider these to be books of mythology, not of history. But these are indeed very great celebrated events in the history of the universe that have taken place. God has personally appeared and shaken hands with the empowered creator of the universe, Brahma. Brahma has performed austerities, and the Lord has very kindly appeared before him, being pleased with him. When Brahma sees him, he is overjoyed, offers his obeisances to the Lord. The Lord, being very pleased with Brahma, slightly smiles and actually shakes his hand. Kare sprishan. Kare means with the hands. Sprishan means to touch or hold. So generally we think of shaking hands as being a Western idea. But anyway, there's something here that started by the Lord himself. But that's something that the Lord can do to his devotees, or a superior can do out of love to somebody. It's not meant to be done for everyone and anyone. The general Vedic custom is to hold your hands together, fold them together and offer respects. It's called the namaskar. Namahkar or namaste. Namaha aste. Namaha. We all are familiar with the word namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya and so on. So the word namaha means to offer obeisances. So when we fold our hand, the very gesture indicates that we are offering our obeisances to somebody, the person in front of us. It's a very deep gesture. So the Vedic culture is a culture of respect. It's not a culture of, hi, howdy, how are you? It's a culture of offering respect to the person we see in front of us by saying, namaha, my obeisances unto you. And a slight bending of the head, it also indicates the same thing. Sometimes we see in the scriptures that obeisances are also offered in that way, by folding hands and bowing the head. Sometimes, of course, when it is feasible, when it is possible, then we offer respects to each other by actually physically bowing down. And then sometimes it is offered with a full body obeisance. So different types or different ways in which one offers respects or one greets other people. So the Supreme Lord has become so pleased with Brahma because of his non-duplicitous austerities and devotional service, that he actually holds his hands and says, Brahma, I'm so pleased with you. And that is indeed some recognition. When the Lord himself does that, that's very special. We see so many instances of the Lord appearing in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first 9 cantos, that is. In the 10th canto, it's a different story. There the Lord is very, very intimate. What to speak of the Lord holding the devotee's hands, the devotees pull his leg. So that's another story. But in the first 9 cantos, we see that the Lord does appear, but he does appear at a distance from the devotee. The devotee is in a mood of awe and reverence upon seeing the Lord, and the Lord maintains that mood. Sometimes, like in the case of Dhruva Maharaj, he may touch his conch shell to the head of the devotee, or he may touch him in a way like that. But in some cases, like this, we see that he's actually shaking his hand. He shakes his hand out of great joy. And then he smiles at him. Smita. Smita means a mild smile. Usually when the Lord appears, he's always got this mild smile with him. The Lord usually never laughs uproariously. Sometimes in Dwarka Leela, we see, in Vrindavan Leela, of course, he may do that as a boy. And in Dwarka Leela, he may sometimes do it when he acts as a king or a prince. Like when there was a man called Pondraka who came, who imagined himself to be Vasudeva or Krishna himself. And he was some kind of what we would nowadays in modern psychology call megalomaniac. And he was thinking himself very, very important, to the extent that he actually thought himself to be God. So this went to such a degree that he actually accepted the insignia or the symbols of Lord Krishna, like the lotus flower, the disc. It was a false disc, of course. Maybe something of the kind our children use in a fancy dress competition or something. And he had the club and so on. So he had all the insignia, fake insignia of the Lord. And he actually sent a messenger to Dwarka, to the assembly hall, with a challenge to Krishna that he should accept Paundraka as a real Vasudev and stop acting as Vasudev, and that he should accept the submission to the feet of Paundraka. So dutifully, Paundraka's messenger came and read out this in the assembly hall of Dwarka. And everybody had such a hearty laugh, they could not stop laughing. Krishna also was heartily laughing at this. And then finally Krishna gave a fitting reply and then said, yes, I will come out and meet Paundraka. And then they met in the battlefield. And there was Paundraka with all his imitation insignia, with the conch shell and the disc and so on, standing there as if he was Vasudev. Of course, it didn't take long for Krishna to deal with him and dispose him. So there are some instances when the Lord may laugh uproariously, but that is when he does a Naralila. There are different kinds of leelas or pastimes that the Lord does. One, he maintains his godhood or his aspect of being God very clearly. He just comes for a very short time, exhibits himself and blesses his devotees and leaves. Or he performs a particular pastime and then goes away. So it's a very, very brief time. Sometimes, however, like when he comes to Vrindavan and Mathura and Dwarka, he stays for a fair amount of time, 125 years. Or when he comes as Lord Ramachandra, then how many years did he stay for? Krishna stayed for 125 years. And Lord Ramachandra, how many years? Any guesses? 10,000, such a long time. But anyone else? Okay, I've put you off the track, but you are very close to the truth. It's 11,000 something years. Of course, that was in Treta Yuga. And Krishna's 125 years was in the end of Dwapar Yuga. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in Kali Yuga and he deliberately had a very short lifespan. How many years did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu perform pastimes? 48 years. So those pastimes in which the Lord remains on the earth and acts as if he's an ordinary human being, that is called Naralila. Whenever the Lord appears in any species of life, he acts according to the way that members of those species would act. When he appears in a fish species as the Matsya avatar, then he acts like a fish. When he comes as a boar, then he acts like a boar. He doesn't act like a human being at that time. Of course, he may speak, but he doesn't otherwise act in the way a human being would do. Similarly, when he acts or appears within the human species, at that time, he acts like a human being. And that's called Naralila. Nara means human. At that time, because human beings sometimes laugh very loudly, or they speak very loudly, especially in India, too loud. So Krishna also sometimes may laugh loudly. But when he appears as the Lord in front of his devotees and to bless them like he does in this case, it's a very brief appearance. And in such appearances, he is very subdued in his actions. Even his smiles, his gestures of affection are subdued. So he will smile mildly. His gestures of affection will also be somewhat controlled, not like in Vrindavan, where there is no limit to the way that the Lord may express his devotion. And to a large degree, even in Dwarka and Mathura. But in such cases, like when the time when he appears before Lord Brahma, the Lord is somewhat subdued. But he's still very pleased. And therefore he's going out of his way to shake hands with Brahma. Because he has accepted Brahma as his worthy son. He has accepted Brahma as being worthy of the one who will create living beings in this universe. He is the Prajapati, the original father of living beings in the universe, acting as God's own representative. And Krishna has empowered Brahma now because Brahma desires to be empowered. Because Brahma desires to be controlled by the Lord, he wants to act for the pleasure of the Lord. And this is Brahma's greatest qualification. Anyone, technically speaking, theoretically, can become Brahma. If that living entity or that jiva has an appropriate stock of pious activities, then one can actually become Brahma. It is said that 100 consecutive lifetimes of perfect discharge of our duties and obligations under the Varnashrama Dharma can entitle one to be in a very high position like that of Brahma. So you can imagine the kind of piety that has to accrue to one to be able to become Brahma. And the kind of qualifications, the kind of intelligence and abilities and powers that Brahma has are inconceivable to the ordinary mortals of this earthly planet. We cannot even imagine such power. So Brahma is given such power because he has deserved it. Because over many, many lifetimes he has accrued such tremendous piety that the Lord gives him the position of the CEO of the universe. So he becomes the top person representing Krishna. And as the creator, he is meant to fulfill the Lord's purpose. He doesn't have an independent purpose to fulfill. Inasmuch as the engineer only fulfills the purpose of the owner. Suppose you own a plot of land and you want to build a building on it, and you commission an architect and an engineer to oversee the building and to actually have the building constructed. So then the architect and the builder sit with the owner. The owner tells them, this is what I would like done. This is how I want the houses constructed. And according to his desire, the architect makes a drawing. And then there's a back and forth. And then the owner says, no, I want this adjusted like this and like that. And then the engineer takes the drawings of the architect. And he then starts constructing, building the building. So similarly, the original design or the original idea is the Lord's. It is according to the Lord's desire that Brahma will start creating this universe. But even for constructing the building, it's a very difficult job. Because we are not talking here of creating a building, an ordinary building. Even those who are unacquainted with the way civil engineering works and with the latest technology will find it astounding to see how huge buildings, skyscrapers are constructed just in a matter of 6 months or 1 year. Such huge cranes and machines get together and how the calculations happen, how the blocks are put together, the foundations made. Actually, it's quite phenomenal, the technological advancement that has taken place considering the development in the last few centuries. So a person who is not acquainted with the subject may find it really amazing. And what is a building? What is a say a 100-story building compared to the construction of the universe, it's not even child's play. It's not even infant's play. The universe is so complicated. Just imagine the scale of complexity in the universe. Today, our scientists have not been able to understand even a tiny fraction of this universe. The way these universal elements have been put together, the way the planetary systems have been constructed, the way they have been distributed throughout the universal space, and then on each planetary system, the kind of arrangements that have been made in terms of the natural environment and so on, the complexity of the coexistence of all the different species there and how the laws of nature are put to work in each planetary system, and how each system is being controlled by a superior, who has a superior, who has a superior, and ultimately the controller of the ultimate supreme entity is the Lord. Such a magnificent setup and arrangement in the universe. And still, there are people who say, it all happened by chance. So therefore, Srila Prabhupada opens his purport with one sentence. The creation of the material world is not blind or accidental. Now, both words are meaningful. Accidental means it happened by chance. This is a very common theory now. It happened by chance. How was the universe created? By chance. But chance, you see, is never a cause. It's a very important philosophical point. Chance is never a cause of something. The cause is always some particular arrangement of things or phenomena which eventually create a result. Now, why those things combined in a certain way, that we do not know. Therefore, we call it chance, and we say chance is the cause of something. Let's say I'm tossing a coin. And then we say, okay, now you predict whether it will be heads or tails. So then we say, okay, we toss it, and then we say, by chance, it was heads. Was it chance that it became heads? What do you think? We may have some top scientists sitting here, maybe. Is it chance that the coin turned heads or tails? No. If you actually were able to analyze, now who, any students of science here, or with people with science background? Nobody? Just one or two? Maybe it's all for the better, I don't know. If you were to analyze minutely all the different forces that act upon the coin as it's tossed, you know, the force of gravity, the force of air resistance, you know, then the tossing of the coin itself, then the spinning as it goes up, and so maybe the wind, and so many factors, and the distance, many things. If you were able to actually calculate every little force and with all the different parameters, the distance and the height and so on, then you would be able to actually predict actually whether it would be heads or tails. You would need to know the elasticity and how it will bounce on the ground. You need to know the nature of the ground. Now, because it's such an insignificant phenomenon, so we don't bother. How are we going to be bothered to just study 100 factors about a tossing of a coin? What difference does it make? So we just say by chance, it, you know, whether it's heads or tails. It means that if you do it a sufficiently large number of times, let's say 1,000 times, then you're likely to get 500 at least as heads and 500 as tails. That's a kind of a probability. So this is how it works statistically. But it doesn't mean that the coin has fallen heads at a particular time by chance. So chance is never a cause. Nothing ever happens by accident. Chance means accident. Chance, as is understood in the world today, as being a cause of something is an unscientific thing. Chance is simply an expression of our ignorance of the cause. When I don't know the cause of something, I say it happened by chance. It's a very easy way to get out of it. It's happening by chance. But that's not a fact. There are some forces behind it. There are some forces that act in certain ways, and because we are unaware of what those forces are and how they act and what their magnitude is and what the circumstances are under which these forces are acting, we think that it is chance. So there is a creator who applies his divine, unlimited, inconceivable intelligence behind it. He has his representatives who have also been empowered with tremendous intellect and ability. And then they, on behalf of the Lord, set up the whole creation. They create it down to the smallest, minutest detail, down to the arrangement of the atoms and the electrons, down to the arrangement of how these small, tiny cells in our body are arranged, and the constituent parts of the cell of our bodies. Everything has been designed perfectly. Brahma doesn't have any CAD, computer-aided design networks, where he can chart out all these things in design, and he's got some software ready. It's all in his brain, because he has been empowered by the Supreme Lord to do it. And it is neither blind. There are some theologies which are trying to accommodate or reconcile the Darwinian theory of evolution with the scriptural understanding of creation of the universe by God. Mostly all the established religions of the world, they postulate or they believe that the universe is created by God. However, modern science, following the law, the theory put forward by Charles Darwin in the Origin of the Species book, they think that everything has happened by chance. By a chance combination of chemicals and elements and so on. So some religionists have, in the modern days, tried to reconcile these two. Why? Because the modern scientific conception, it's not actually so scientific a conception, this Darwinian evolution theory. But nevertheless, so because people have, by and large, become so convinced that this evolution theory is the gospel truth, that's become like the modern scripture of the scientists. So they think that there are only prophets and scriptures and religion, but science also has its prophets and scriptures. And that is the dogma. That is the truth. And then because of the propaganda that this is the truth and there is no God, there is no question of creation by a God, it's all happening by chance arrangements. So there is a lot of criticism that religion has had to face. And the concept of creation by God and his representatives is considered very irrational, illogical, unscientific. So being on the defensive, religionists have always tried to defend the idea of God being responsible for creation. And sometimes religionists like these, they may actually go to the point of trying to say, well, Darwin was not completely wrong. Religion, well, we have to understand it in this way. And what is the way they try to justify it? They say, well, the creation was set in motion by God. That means a spark was set in was set by God. But after that, it was all blind. Then evolution took place. So this is the way they are trying to reconcile the Darwinian theory of creation with the theory of God being the creator. So they say, yes, both are true. So God is also the creator and evolution has also happened. Now, surprisingly, we also believe that God is the creator and things evolved. Yes, from Srimad Bhagavatam we believe that, but in a different way. Number one, God is the creator ultimately, yes. And then things evolve, but not blindly. Not by chance. At every stage of the evolution process of the universe, the physical universe as well as the species and so on, it is being supervised very meticulously, very carefully. It doesn't happen blindly. So some of these religionists today say that it's happened blindly after the creation by the Lord. But no, it's not blind. God is not blind. And God always remains in control of His creation. Now, when these religionists say that God set in motion the creation, but after that it happened on its own, what it means is that God is not in control of His creation. But God is ever the controller. There is never a moment when God is not in charge of anything. He is always in charge of everything, at all times, in all circumstances. Otherwise, what kind of a God is He? That means that chance is greater than God. That means chance is God. So therefore, God not being in control of the creation of the universe or evolution of the universe at any time is a contradiction in terms. That means we have not understood who God is, who the absolute truth is, and what does it mean to be the absolute truth. So the absolute truth is not just the origin of everything, but He is also the supreme controller of everything at every time. Mayadhyakshena prakritihi suyate sacharacharam hetunanena kaunteya jagat viparivartate. Krishna says very clearly in the Bhagavad Gita that He is the controller of the material nature. All living and non-living entities are under His control at all times. He is not like an imperfect controller of this world. Even Brahma sometimes cannot control certain things. And He gets anxious about things. But the Supreme Lord is not like that. Supreme Lord's power is complete and perfect. So we see in the Srimad Bhagavatam the description of the creation and the evolution. And there are many stages in which the evolution takes place, physically and in terms of the life forms, the different species that originate. And at every stage we see there is the Lord. We could roughly compare the creation process to the cooking of a meal. Now, can we ever imagine that a meal will come about by chance? You know, some of our Prabhus, you go home and you're hungry and you ask your wife, you know, please, is the prasadam ready? She said, no, it'll happen by chance, let it happen. You're not going to be very pleased with that answer. You're not going to sit and discuss philosophy at that time. Even a chapati or a slice of bread cannot come about by chance. So how do we expect the entire creation to come about by chance? So let's compare the creation process to the act of cooking a meal. What are the things that you require to cook a meal? What are the different elements involved? Can you mention some of them? Number one? Sorry? Fire. You need fire. Okay. What else? Sorry? Water. Alright, water. Hair. What did you say? Air. Okay, air. Yes. Vessels. Sorry? Effort of making it by whom? Just cook. That's right. That's the most important part of the whole meal. Of course, that doesn't mean if the cook is standing there without ingredients, then he can't do anything also. But if the ingredients are all there and there's no cook, nothing's going to happen. Yes.
Consciousness of the cook.
Consciousness of the cook, alright, yes. But ultimately, whatever the consciousness, he will come up with some meal. So you, basically, let's look at it like this. You need the cook, who's the most important element. You need the ingredients for the meal, which means you need rice, you need wheat, you need sugar, you need salt, you need so many vegetables and so on. You need fuel or something that will facilitate the cooking to happen. You need vessels or a favorable circumstance. So similarly, who is the ultimate cook? The Supreme Lord. But he's like the chief cook who actually just oversees. He doesn't come and get involved like a chef in a big hotel. He may just come and do a little touching up and something. If somebody doesn't do something, if someone doesn't do something right, he just comes and says, do it like that. By oversight, but he oversees everything. But there are cooks that work under him. He's got an assistant head cook who actually does it. That's Brahma. So Brahma is going to do all the tasks of creation. But it's the head cook's responsibility. He's the administrator of the kitchen. So he basically arranges all the ingredients and everything. So then Brahma has all these ingredients. So the assistant head cook has the sugars, the salt, the vegetables and everything. Then he starts cutting it up. He starts doing everything that is required. The vessels are also required. So the vessels are provided by Maya. Maya is like the womb. We can consider, according to Chaitanya Charitamrita, we can consider the material nature to be mother. We say that, even English language, we say mother nature. So she is the mother. She is the mother of the 84 or 8.4 million species of life. The different types of bodies are all coming from mother nature. So she is the mother. And it is within her womb that these 8.4 million species of life and the planetary systems actually are nourished and they grow. So just as the mother performs two functions for the child in the womb, what are the two functions the mother performs for the child in the womb? She nourishes the child and she nourishes, what else? She provides a space and the protection for the child. The womb provides the space within which the fetus exists and within which the fetus can grow. Also, the mother provides the ingredients for the building of the child's body, the fetus's body, and therefore nourishes the fetus. So in the same way, Mother Nature provides the accommodating space for the 8.4 million species of life and all the planetary systems. That's the material cosmos. And then she also provides the ingredients for building our bodies, for building the planets, for building the space and so on. So that is Mother Nature, that's Maya Devi. So once all these ingredients are there, now these ingredients are taken and put together. Now the cook would probably light the fire and then have a vessel. So you need an accommodating space. You need storage space for the ingredients. And then when you put them in the pot in which the cooking is going to take place, you also need space provided by the vessel. And then there is fire. But you let the fire go uncontrolled? It has to be very controlled fire, isn't it? And for cooking different types of items, you need the fire at different levels. Sometimes a high flame, sometimes a low flame for a long time. So those are good cooks. You know the nuances of handling the fire properly. You must know how to regulate the fire. And then there is stirring required sometimes. Then at certain times in the cooking, you'd add some ingredients at given times. Now you add one thing. After a while, you add something else. It's all very carefully considered. It's not that you put everything all at one time, just light a fire, just leave it, and then everything happens. You get a wonderful pizza or a chapati or something. It doesn't happen like that. So similarly, the material creation just doesn't happen. Just put the ingredients all together and just expect that everything will work out into a great universe with Melbourne and Sydney and everything all there. It doesn't happen like that. So at every stage, there is intervention in the form of the Lord's glance, according to the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Lord's glance is like that stirring and like that supervision. So at every stage of the creation, even after Brahma comes in, the Lord's mercy is required. And by careful supervision, careful intervention, careful application of mind and intelligence, good management, then the universe emerges. Step by step, step by step, there is combination to more complex, you know, objects. And then the different species are also, they also evolve in that way. So we also believe that there is evolution, but not in the way that Darwin believed. The different species emerged from other species. From Brahma came his sons, and in some cases the daughters. And then from them came further progeny. And some of these progeny were of different species. Now, we can't imagine something like this. You know, humans can bring forth only humans. Human beings, two human beings coming together cannot bring forth some third species of life. Because it's not there in our DNA. But in the DNA of those advanced living entities, it was possible by the laws of God. So these species of life, the higher species in the universe, they were able to bring forth species different from themselves because it was there programmed in their DNA. It was possible to do these things. So therefore the species of life originated from higher species of life. Higher species of life gave birth to the lower species of life, and progressively this happened over a period of time. We also believe in evolution in another way, that it is the individual soul that transmigrates from body to body, species to species. It is not that, as Darwin believed, the body itself evolves. So you had the ape-like human beings, the monkeys, and then the ape-like human beings, and eventually the ape-like body evolved into the human's body. No, it doesn't work like that. And Srila Prabhupada says, the monkeys are here, the apes are here, and the humans are also here. If the apes evolve into the humans, then the apes should not have remained. But the apes are still here. So therefore, the creation that is happening is like the cooking of a meal where it requires constant supervision, intervention, intelligence, skill, and so on. Even a minor deviation can cause so much difference. Imagine if you forget to put salt. It's just a small thing. But does it make a big difference to the meal? Yes. Just a little salt. But that may make so much difference. So similarly, nowadays scientists say that the earth is so perfectly balanced that if we were a little closer to the sun, we would have got burnt. If we were a little further away from the sun, we would have got frozen. Even by a little. So it's all being perfectly planned, perfectly arranged. How can we say these things are blind and accidental? Yes, creation does happen. There was one very famous scientist. He was a British astrophysicist. His name was Fred Hoyle. He was very famous in the 1950s and 60s. As a student, we used to hear about him and talk about him somewhat. So, even though he was a mainstream scientist, but he disbelieved in the laws of in evolution, Darwinian evolution, or in the Big Bang. So he had this famous analogy that he gave. He said the chances of the universe coming about by Big Bang or by chance are similar to the chances of a typhoon blowing through a junkyard and leaving behind in its wake a perfect jumbo jet. Now, what kind of statistical probabilities or possibilities are we talking about? Do you think it's a very likely event? But what do scientists say? Well, it's unlikely, but it's that one in million. But that one in million has happened here, so we are here to talk about it. If that one in a million or one in 100 trillion or whatever it is didn't happen, we wouldn't have been talking about it. So in this way, they actually skirt around the real issue that every cause, every effect has a cause. And when the cause is unknown due to our limited experience and intelligence, we say it happened by chance. But these things don't happen by chance. So Brahma's empowerment happens because Brahma has pleased Krishna by his non-duplicitous penance and service. The Lord is very pleased to say, yes, Brahma, now I want to empower you to be my representative. And what is the purpose of this creation? As Srila Prabhupada mentions here, it is to give a chance to the ever-conditioned nitya-baddha living entities of this world to come back to Godhead. The conditioned living entities of this world have forgotten their Lord and Master, Sri Krishna. And they are suffering here for want of that love, that loving relationship with the Supreme Lord. And all it needs is for us to revive that relationship, to be happy again, get released from the bondage of this material world and return to the spiritual world. So the whole creation is designed like that. In fact, the creation is designed to give us suffering. Why is it designed to give us suffering? In modern psychology, if somebody arranges something for somebody else's suffering, he's called by certain uncharitable terms. So why has Krishna designed this place to be a place of suffering? Does he get some joy to see the suffering of the living entities? No. He has done this in a way that sometimes the parent punishes the child. Does the parent feel great joy in punishing the child? Does the parent feel a sense of accomplishment that, okay, now I've punished my child and given him pain? No, it is very painful to the parent. But the parent does it for the rectification, for the improvement of the child, so that the child may mend his ways, so that the child may come back to the proper standard of behavior and thinking. It's done for the welfare of the child. Whatever God does is out of love. The Lord is situated always on the absolute platform. So he never acts in a sense of duality, feeling enmity for someone, feeling friendship for somebody else. No. Or feeling love for someone and feeling hatred for somebody else. It doesn't work like that. The Lord's every action is prompted by one and only one emotion, and that is love. In this world, we are prompted in our actions by varying emotions depending on which modes of nature we are under at that moment. Sometimes we are very loving because we are under the control of one mode of nature. The next moment we may flare up and fight with somebody because we become controlled by another mode of nature. But the Lord is never like that. The Lord is always the master of the modes of nature. He is never under the control of the modes of material nature. He is pure love personified. He is the embodiment of compassion, mercy and love. And therefore even the creation of the universe is an act of love, even though it may cause pain and suffering. to the living entities. It causes pain even to Krishna. And therefore Krishna is more keen than us that we should return to the spiritual world. We are apparently blissful in living here in this world, blissful in our ignorance. Ignorance is bliss. But it's actually not, ignorance is not bliss actually. So the Lord is more keen that we should go back to the spiritual world than we are. Inasmuch as, imagine a drunken man lying on the street, completely inebriated. Now he doesn't think that he's sorrowful, he's in a bad condition. He thinks he's blissful. He's lying there, you go and talk to him, he'll be very cheery, hello, how are you? And he'll smile at you, he'll laugh at you, he may joke with you. And you feel pity on him and tell him, please, come back, you're suffering. He says, I'm not suffering. But as his friend, you are more keen that he should come back home and be restored to a normal condition than he is. He is not even in a position to understand his suffering condition. So how will he then develop the desire to move out of that condition? Only when someone appreciates or understands that I'm suffering will he try to do something to alleviate that suffering. But if someone thinks he's happy, he thinks he doesn't need to do anything to change his situation. So similarly, the illusory energy of the Lord, Maya, is so strong that it makes the conditioned living entity believe that he or she is happy even in the midst of intense suffering. So this is the situation of the conditioned living entities. Srila Prabhupada used to tell the story of Indra, who once offended his spiritual master and was cursed to be a hog. And then the time period of the curse elapsed. But Indra showed no indication of wanting to come back. He was not in an ordinary position. He was the king of the heavenly planets. And that's not an ordinary position. That's really a very high position. A very exalted position. He's a representative of Krishna, overseeing all the demigods. And when Indra became a hog, he got so preoccupied in his situation as a hog that he didn't think that was anything demeaning or it was any unfortunate situation. Wherever we are, Maya makes us think everything is, as they say, hunky-dory. So then he was there, and because he was a king of heaven in his former birth, so naturally he couldn't be an ordinary hog, so he was a king of hogs. So he had his family and he had his, you know, subjects and everything. And Narad Muni, the great devotee, being very compassionate, was thinking, what is this? Indra is just showing no signs of wanting to come back. You know, the chair is vacant in the heavenly planets. And Indra just wants to remain. So he came and told Indra, come on, you're Indra. You should come back now. And Indra said, well, Narad Muni, I understand what you're saying, but look, just look at my family. Look at my subjects. I have these little piglets which oink, oink, they go such a nice way. And, you know, they need my shelter, they need my care. Who's going to look after them if I leave all of a sudden? And the subjects, they're dependent on me as the king. If I go, then who's going to lead the kingdom of hogs? Finally, Narad Muni had to relieve him of his body and then forcefully send him back to the heavenly planet. Such is the nature of Maya. So powerful is the illusory potency of the Lord that even a suffering person imagines himself to be happy. Or rather, the concept of or conception of happiness is when there is relief from distress. There is no concept of positive happiness in this material world. The so-called happiness of this world is only a phase, a temporary phase of relief from distress. If we are experiencing some terrible distress, and you get some relief from it and your problem is solved for the time being, then you think you are happy. Why do you think you're happy? Because now you have no problem. But the now in bracket is very important. It's only now that I don't seem to have problems. But it's going to come very soon, very shortly. So therefore, Brahma's task is to design this material world in such a way, keeping in mind the Lord's purpose. So Maya Devi is there with her trident, always subjecting the conditioned living entities to the three types of miseries. Adi Daivika Klesha, Adi Bhautika Klesha, Adhyatmika Klesha. Miseries inflicted by other living entities, miseries inflicted by one's own body and mind, and miseries inflicted by nature. Brahma, meanwhile, also plays the compassionate role. He inaugurates a sampradaya, a party of devotees. And that's what Srila Prabhupada talks about in the second part of his purport, where there is opportunity for the conditioned souls to receive the mercy of the Lord through Krishna consciousness, through the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. So Brahma has inaugurated this sampradaya and he has started this disciplic succession coming down from him. And that knowledge and practice of Krishna consciousness is accessible and available to us even today. And it will continue to be available so long as this universe exists. Of course, this particular Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya will remain strongly only for the next 10,000 years, and then Kali Yuga will come in a very powerful way. If we think there is a lot of suffering now, just wait till the next 10,000 years. Then we'll know what real suffering is. But better not to wait. Better to avail of Lord Brahma's mercy. Better to avail of the facility of the Brahma Sampradaya that Lord Brahma has kindly made available to us. Let us connect ourselves to this disciplic succession, which has in turn been made available to us by Srila Prabhupada through the ISKCON movement, which is also Brahma's movement, which is Narad Muni's movement, which is Krishna's movement, Mahaprabhu's movement. And let us become fully Krishna conscious and go back to Godhead and fulfill the Lord's purpose for which He had made this creation. So we'll stop here. Sorry, I have gone far over time. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Yes. No problem. Prabhupada says in the purport here that there are many renegades from the Brahma Sampradaya whose only business is to make men more forgetful of the Lord and thus entangle them more and more in material existence. So, probably what Prabhupada means here is that they are sinful souls who don't want to listen to the message of Lord Brahma. Brahma is here to teach us Krishna consciousness too. You see, in one hand, he wears different hats. In one hand, he's the creator, he's busy doing the management. But then he also wears another hat, he's a preacher and a teacher. And his business is to teach Krishna consciousness to the souls of this universe. But there are some people who don't pay attention to Brahma's message of Krishna consciousness. They just want to do their sinful activities. So these are those who are the renegades from the Brahma Sampradaya. They don't want to attach themselves to Brahma's pure message. They want to be independent and try to enjoy this universe. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Maharaj, in the starting you said that when Krishna came to shake Brahma's hand, he was overjoyed. Did Brahma ever go to Krishna to see him by form, normal form?
So what is your name?
Gopal.
Gopal, okay. So Gopala is asking that Krishna came to shake Brahma's hands. Did Brahma go to Krishna's kingdom to see Krishna?
Before?
No. Krishna came to reveal himself to Brahma in Brahma's home. And sitting there, as Brahma was sitting in his home, in his abode, Krishna revealed his own abode. That means Krishna's abode to Brahma. There was a very transcendental telecast, television show. Brahma actually sitting in Brahma Loka was able to visualize the entire Vaikuntha Loka, the kingdom of God, by Krishna's mercy. Yes. Okay, so the question is that in the earlier part of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is explained by Brahma himself that by the Lord's mercy, he can't fall into illusion. And then later on in the 10th canto, we see that there is the Brahma Vimohana Leela, in which Brahma apparently is bewildered. So how does one reconcile these apparent contradictions? Brahma is an acharya. He is a pure devotee, at least our Brahma is. Every Brahma may or may not be. So yes, he is free from illusion in the sense that he is not like any ordinary conditioned living entity who falls under the clutches of Maya ordinarily. He is very elevated, he is very exalted. But whenever Brahma seems to be bewildered, we must understand it to be the workings of Yoga Maya. That illusory power which is reserved only for special exalted living entities, like Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva was also bewildered with the Mohini Murti. But he was bewildered not by the Maya energy of the Lord, the illusory energy of the Lord, but he was bewildered directly by the Lord himself. When the Lord came personally, that was when Brahma was bewildered. Similarly, when the Lord came as Mohini Murti, that's when Shiva was bewildered. But the ordinary living entities are bewildered just by the display of the illusory potency of the Lord. And actually through the Brahma Vimohana Leela, the acharyas say that Brahma actually wanted to glorify Lord Krishna. He wanted to see Lord Krishna's super excellent qualities getting exhibited and his opulences getting demonstrated to the world. He wanted to see that for himself and he wanted the world to see that. Okay. Any other question or comment? Yes. About? So your question is, how far will your devotional service, or how far will Krishna reciprocate with your devotional service to help you to come out of the modes of material nature? Yes? Well, he will reciprocate according to the intensity and sincerity of your desire and efforts in Krishna consciousness. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Daivihi esha gunamai mama maya duratyaya mam eva ye prapatyante mayam etam tarantite. He said, this material energy of mine that comprises the three modes is my divine energy, and it is practically impossible to surpass. But one who surrenders to me completely will easily be able to cross over this material energy. In other words, will be able to transcend the three modes of nature. So it is only by the process of complete surrender to Sri Krishna can we actually do that. So we have to adopt this surrendering process, which means, in brief, to follow Krishna's instructions, which means to follow his representative's instructions. So Srila Prabhupada has given us so many instructions through his teachings. So if we follow that, then we can transcend the modes of nature and be situated on the transcendental platform and eventually go home back to Godhead. Hare Krishna. All right, so thank you very much. Okay, some more questions? Yes. Who is going to deliver the next generations when after 10,000 years the Gaudiya Vaishnava movement, the Hare Krishna movement may not remain? Well, 10,000 years is a fairly long time. Many generations can come in 10,000 years, especially when we see that in Kali Yuga the lifespans will get shorter and shorter. So you're going to have many, many generations in 10,000 years. But I wouldn't want to be around for those many generations. We'd rather get away as soon as possible. But in the process, we'd like to take many, many people with us. So for the next 10,000 years, this movement will blossom, will flourish. But after 10,000 years, then Kali Yuga will set in full force. And for many years, it will be difficult for conditioned living entities to avail of this movement, the benefits of this movement. Nevertheless, Krishna consciousness will never be lost. There will always be a disciplic succession that is going on somewhere. The disciplic succession of the saintly people will continue on. It is an unbroken line. The saints are somewhere unseen by ordinary humans, like Vyasadeva is there somewhere. So this will be revived again, but by the Lord's arrangement, the Kali Yuga, the intense period of Kali Yuga will come at that time. Yes, so at that time it is going to be hard. So better we should take Krishna consciousness so seriously that we don't have to wait for that period. Okay, so thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. God Premanande. Ki jai.